Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome to our meeting of the Commonwealth Club. I'm Ralph Baxter, and it is my pleasure to welcome all of you to tonight's program. This is the first in a series of programs that we at ORIC are sponsoring with the Commonwealth Club, a series we call the AHA Speaker Series, in which we will bring speakers here to the Commonwealth Club from all over the world with different perspectives from different disciplines to share with us their thoughts about developments and events in the world, events and developments that are shaping our future and will shape and are shaping our present. Tonight, we are delighted to have as our first speaker in the series, Paul Krugman. Paul does not require much introduction, but let me say a few things before I turn the podium over to him. Paul Krugman was educated at Yale as an undergraduate and got his PhD from MIT, and he is now a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton. Of course, he is perhaps better known for his op-ed columns in the New York Times, but he writes much more broadly than that. Paul Krugman has written 20 books. He has authored more than 200 papers in professional journals, and, of course, now has his most recent book, The Conscience of a Liberal, in publication. And tonight, Paul will talk about that book and his views of economic inequality and political change in America. Paul?
Well, good evening, and I may cough at some point during here. I think I'm allergic to these times we live in, I think, or something. Anyway, so you're going to hear some of that. Sorry. That was not staged. That was real. Okay. Okay. So I'm really going to talk about the book, The Conscience of a Liberal. And it's a book, you know, it's newly out. It's... last time I was on book tour, it was a book that was, for the most part, a collection of columns, and they were a reaction to the times we were in. This time, I've tried to figure out how we got to where we are, and is there a way out, I guess is the way to put it. I've actually had some... I've noticed some disappointment in reviews or comments by relatively conservative people saying there isn't a whole lot of Bush bashing in this book. And I guess the answer is, you know, been there, done that, and trying to figure out where we go next. And so let me tell you the core of what is on my mind and is in my book. There are, I would say, two great puzzles about America. Now, I'm a baby boomer, grew up in the society of, you know, the 50s and the 60s. And we thought that society was in many ways the sort of end state where a mature country got. It was a broadly middle-class society. There was a poverty problem, which attracted a great deal of attention, but there weren't a lot of very rich people, and there was a broad equality of economic conditions among most of the population. It was also a society which had a relative, despite all the turmoil of the 60s, and in terms of politics, there was a strong center. There was a lot of agreement about basic principles about what our government was for, what the shape of society ought to be, and there was a real possibility of bipartisan action. So if you look at the major legislation of the time, something like Medicare was created with a lot of votes from both parties, and actually with some opposition from both parties, but it was really an ability to cooperate to get things done. And it all went away. And so there are, from my point of view, these two great puzzles. One of them is economic. What happened to middle-class America? The other is political. Why have the politics gone the way they have? And let me just talk for a second about the economic puzzle first, and then which then leads to the political puzzle. So the economic puzzle is this. There is a debate among economists about whether the typical family, the median family, has experienced a gain in standard of living and income since the early 1970s, where you can cut it back and forth various ways. Median income is up, but that's entirely because more spouses are working. You can go back and forth. Are we measuring prices right? They didn't have DVD players, so on. The outcome of that debate is not important. What's stunning is the fact that it's even debatable. Go back. We're talking about 35 years. The end of the great post-war boom is usually dated to 1973. In 1973, there were no personal computers, no internet. Fax machines were extremely expensive things that basically only major news organizations had. Ships were unloaded by guys toting big bags of stuff. No freight containerization, no barcode scanners. We're a vastly richer, more productive society than we were in the early 70s, and yet we're not sure. It's within the realm of argument whether the typical family has gained anything. How's that possible? The answer, of course, is that there were huge, huge gains at the top of the income distribution. A few people got much, much richer, and that took all or almost all of the gains. We talk about a second Gilded Age, referring back to the era of the robber barons, and that is not a metaphor. It's not hyperbole. It's not exaggeration. By the numbers, the distribution of income in the United States in 2005 almost exactly matched what it was in the 1920s. So it may be not quite the age of J.P. Morgan, although, but certainly the Great Gatsby. We're certainly fully back to levels of inequality that have not been seen since the 1920s. It's an extraordinary thing. So first question is, how did that happen? How was it possible for inequality to grow that much? And talk about that in a moment. The second question is, why hasn't the political system had a backlash against that? If you had told somebody just in the abstract, look, we're going to see a tremendous concentration of income at the top of the spectrum, stagnation of wages for most workers over a period of several decades, obvious explosion of great wealth, you might have expected. In fact, standard political theories would lead you to think that there would be a demand for, there would be a pressure to raise taxes on the rich and provide stronger social safety net. You might even have expected to see Huey Long make a second coming, soak the rich. But at least you would have expected some kind of political backlash against that. In fact, on the contrary, the trend of our politics, at least until very, very recently, has been towards in the opposite direction, that the Republican Party has become increasingly a party of lower taxes, lower tax rates on people with high income, deregulation, privatization of parts of the social insurance system, and has by and large won more elections than it has lost. So the political trend has actually been to the right when you might have thought that growing inequality would push to the left. So how did that happen? Okay. What I argue in Conscience of a Liberal is, first of all, that a lot of the increase in inequality is in fact political at its root. That politics drives economics. Now, this is not the way economists, right? I'm a card-carrying economist. Maybe they'll revoke my license here. But this is not the way economists are supposed to think, except that most economists who have looked hard at the long-term developments in inequality are driven in this direction. Let me give you a few things that people may not be aware of. The first is that the middle-class society I grew up in did not evolve gradually. You might think that there was there was the era of the robber barons, and then gradually America turned into the America of Ozzie and Harriet, whatever, that it gradually evolved into this middle-class society. That is not what the data or, the available stories tell us. What they tell us is, in fact, that as far as we can tell, the Gilded Age lasted right through the 1920s. America, on the eve of the New Deal, was very nearly as unequal as it had been in the 1890s. And that the middle-class, relatively egalitarian society was created in a very short period of time, between the late 1930s and the end of World War II. The economic historians called it the Great Compression, because the income differences got compressed. And it's as important a story about 20th century America as the Great Depression, which we all know about, though it's much less told. And you look at what happened, and it was the Roosevelt administration, through a whole set of policies, but all of them equalizing, much higher tax rates on the wealthy, higher corporate tax rates, a pro-union organizing environment, so you had an explosion in union membership, tripling of the share of the workforce, the minimum wage, Social Security, unemployment insurance, all of these things. And then the process accelerated because during World War II, there were extensive government controls on the economy, which were used in a way that tended to equalize incomes. All this created a middle-class society in a period of not more than about 7 or 8 years. Now, you might have thought, well, okay, but, you know, this is all artificial, especially the stuff during the war, so it would, you know, would go away as soon as peacetime returned. But it didn't. Turns out that once you create institutions, norms, expectations of a relatively equal society, it tends to persist. So the income distribution, this relatively middle-class society that was created by the New Deal, persisted for more than a generation after World War II. Then it started to come apart. And you see this dramatic increase in inequality, not quite as fast as the Great Compression, but this dramatic increase starting around 1980, which in itself is kind of an interesting date because that's Reagan comes to the White House. And it turns out that the increase in inequality in the United States is unique to the United States. So other advanced countries have not seen anything like it. The closest thing you can see to the U.S., to this unequalization that's taken place in the United States is in Britain during the Thatcher years, which again is itself a little bit revealing. Nothing remotely. You just look at the charts and we are off the charts in terms of this increase in inequality. And many of the things that we take for granted as, well, this is the way things work in the modern, the late 20th, early 21st century economy, turn out to be special to the U.S. So one example I like to use is the decline of the union movement. We all know that unions are outmoded and you can't, you know, it's global competition and all that. Except, well, here's a comparison people don't know. In the 1960s, Canada, that's, you know, the country up there, they almost speak the same language, eh? But anyway, in the 1960s, Canada and the United States had roughly the same percentage of their workers in unions, about 30% in both countries. Today, Canada still has almost 30% of its workers in unions. In the United States, it's down to about 11%, and much less than that, it's in the private sector. It's heavily a public sector thing left. So the deunionization was not something that happened because of the global economy, because Canada faces the same global economy we do. It was something that happened here. And how did it happen? Well, when you look into it closely, you discover that it was political. Basically, Ronald Reagan, above all, though it started before him, declared open season for union busters. During the 1980s, about one in every 20 workers who voted for a union was illegally fired. And the reason, sure, we're less of an industrial society, but there's no inherent reason why giant service sector companies, you know, the iconic corporation of the 60s was General Motors, the iconic corporation of today is Walmart. There's no inherent reason why those companies should not be unionized. In fact, similar enterprises are in the rest of the world, but because the shift to a service economy took place in an environment in which politicians, the dominant political forces, said it was okay to bust unions in the way that people had in the 1920s, we've had this dramatic decline in unionization in the United States. So it is not, and that in turn has all kinds of ramifications for the income distribution. So I can talk about it at some length, but there's a lot of reason to believe that politics has driven this dramatic increase in inequality. Sure, technology is there, globalization is there, but it is very largely political. I should say one more thing. There's a view on inequality that you hear all the time, which is, well, it's all about the increased demand for skills for education in the modern world economy. You know, and there's no doubt something to that, but if you actually look at the numbers, The huge growth in disparities has not been between the college-educated and the non-college-educated. Yes, people with college degrees have done better than people without, but most of the increase is among people with a lot of education. Most dramatic statistic, high school teachers tend to have postgraduate degrees, and so do hedge fund managers. And as we all know, the highest paid hedge fund manager in the United States made an amount equal to the salaries of all 80,000 New York City school teachers for the next 3 years. So this is it's not education that is driving this. It's not that simple. Politics. Why haven't we had a backlash? Well, or put it this way, how has it been that during this period of rapidly rising inequality, we've seen the top tax rates fall? You know, back when that socialist Dwight Eisenhower was president, the top marginal tax rate was 91%. And it was 70% through much of the 60s and 70s, and is now 35. Capital gains tax rate has been cut from 28 to 15, and so on down the line. The taxes that apply most heavily to the people who have been the big beneficiaries of growing inequality have been cut. Social programs have been eroded where it was possible, although Social Security and Medicare are still there. How is that possible, but why has politics moved to the right? Well, that's a two-part story. The first is the change in the Republican Party. You can actually measure positions. Democrats are not, or have not been until recently, significantly to the left of where they've been historically. You know, was Bill Clinton to the left of John F. Kennedy? Not in any noticeable way. Republican Party has moved a long way to the right, and it's because it was, in effect, captured by something that I call movement conservatism. But it's not actually my name. It's what the movement conservatives themselves call it. There is a conservative, yes, Virginia, there is a vast right-wing conspiracy. But it's not hidden. It's not secret. There's an overlapping set of institutions that create a lot of incentives to follow what amounts to a party line. So it's the institute, the whole range from the Heritage Foundation to Fox News. You can very clearly see it's cohesive. You look at a lot of these institutions, you ask, where does the funding come from? And the same five or six large right-wing foundations come up again and again. It's really, it is a cohesive movement. They won't really tell you otherwise. Although I've always thought that the obsession with George Soros on the right comes partly from the fact that they think there must be a sinister billionaire organizing things, because, after all, that's the way things work on their side. How does it take over? Well, a lot of it is, the personal incentives are quite strong. So you look at the tale of two Republican senators who lost their seats last year. Lincoln Chafee, I believe, got a one-year teaching appointment at Brown. Rick Santorum, and he was, Lincoln Chafee was an Eisenhower Republican, essentially. If you go back, Eisenhower said to people who he wrote a famous letter to his brother, revealed after his death, that talking about people who thought that you could roll back the New Deal, people who thought you could get rid of Social Security and unemployment insurance and all that, and he said they are a tiny minority and they are stupid. But in fact, today we have a Republican Party. The key institutions of movement conservatism actually believe and try to do exactly that. So fundraising letters from the Heritage Foundation will say that, never forget, connect the dots. Our goal is to undo the New Deal and the Great Society. In other words, basically Social Security and Medicare. These are alien. These are bad institutions. They want to roll this back. If you're a Republican who isn't a movement conservative, well, there isn't much there. If you are, so the other one is Rick Santorum. Immediately there was a program created for him to head at a right-wing think tank, the New America's Enemies program. And so there you are with, this is the, some of my progressive friends call it wingnut welfare. But anyway, there's a whole set of incentives, very strong. Now, nonetheless, this would not, this kind of hardline right position, seized the Republican nomination for Barry Goldwater, but then went down to terrible defeat. And when the Republicans did get the White House under Richard Nixon, Nixon was not actually, in many ways, Nixon governed as a liberal. It's not clear. Nixon didn't seem to have much of any ideology except that he should be running things. And it was it wasn't until but what Nixon did, what made it possible for this to change America was the ability to win elections. And so the question has to be, if you have what is essentially an anti-populist, elitist economic philosophy that has taken over one of America's two great parties during a time of rising inequality, how is it that this can win elections? And the answer actually is that it has never done so by running on the economic ideology. Economics is what it's about. If you actually ask, what does Heritage Foundation care about? What does management really want? It is about economics. It is about trying to roll things back. It is Grover Norquist. Do we people know the Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Action? We like him in a way. He's the great anti-tax cut enforcer. And somebody pointed out that Grover Norquist is sort of like a James Bond villain who explains at length his evil plans. And so we like to quote him. And the quote everyone uses is the one about getting the government down to the size where you can drown it in a bathtub. But the one I always liked is when asked what he wants, he said he wants to get America back to the way it was before Teddy Roosevelt and the socialists came in. So undo the 21st. Okay. But this is... But we're not talking about some crank. We're talking about somebody who actually, until last November, was part of the Republican process of vetting people who got lobbyist appointments, a central part of the whole mechanism. Okay, how does this win elections? And the answer is by running on other things. So in some ways, the 2004 election was a perfect illustration. Bush wins the election by being America's defender against gay married terrorists. And then barely have the networks called the election. And he says, and now our first priority is to privatize Social Security, which came as kind of a shock to a lot of people who voted for him. But that's fairly typical. All right. When I looked in some detail at the political history, it turns out that although there are a chapter entitled Weapons of Mass Distraction, but it turns out that the core of it, although national security clearly swung the 2002 and 2004 elections, actually the moral value stuff much less important, the enduring source of the ability of movement conservatism to win elections has in fact not been that. It has been race. The centrality of race to the American political story was not something I expected to find when I began working on this book, but it just becomes overwhelmingly clear once you start to do the work. So let me give you a story and a statistic, and then we can talk about it a bit more. The story is this: when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he turned to his Bill Moyers, who was then his young aide, and he said, "We've just given the South to the GOP for my lifetime and yours," and that appears to actually have been right. And so if you look, to an extraordinary extent, what has happened in American politics can be seen as the success of Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. Amazing amount. Once you take account of just five words, Southern whites started voting Republican, there isn't much left over to explain. So here's my statistic from Larry Bartels in the politics department at Princeton. We all know that white males have turned on the Democratic Party, have left the Democratic Party, and there's a whole list of reasons given for that. But it's not exactly true unless you add an additional word, which is it's really just Southern white males who have left the Democratic Party. In 1952, of non-Southern white males, 40% voted Democratic. In 2004, 39%. All the stories you've heard about alienated working class voters and in the country, once you take account of the Great Southern Switch, there's nothing left to explain. Nothing much happened. The stories you've seen about evangelicals are very largely, not entirely, but very largely just about the Southern switch, because there are a lot more evangelicals in the South. Almost everything else boils away. Now, I said Southern white switch might not be might not be about race. Thank you. Yeah, this is, sorry, it's going to be, you may never get the end of the story. We'll see whether I can get there. What are the reasons for thinking that it is, aside from the sort of the obvious timing? And the answer actually, of course, is that the politicians very clearly sought to use race as a way to win elections. So that, well, in some ways, Nixon famously had the Southern strategy. And there's a lot of, you know, the legacy of the Nixon administration in our politics remains very strong, often in terms of even the individuals. So Dick Cheney gets a start in the Nixon administration. People forget that Roger Ailes, the head of Fox News, was Richard Nixon's media guru. So there's this direct line of descent. That Karl Rove was Lee Atwater's disciple. Lee Atwater had the famous late-in-life interview where he said, talked about using race in politics, and we said something along the lines of, we used to say nigger, 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 and now we say taxes and welfare, but it's the same message. But more specifically, look, one of the key figures in the conscience of a liberal is Ronald Reagan, who is I think probably the pivotal figure in the change in America, but not in the way that the hagiography of, you know, St. Ronald has made him. The real Ronald Reagan was certainly there was a harshness to it. If you read the famous 1964 speech that made Ronald Reagan a national figure, an extraordinary thing to read, partly because of the sheer mean-spiritedness of it. So he makes fun of John F. Kennedy for having said that millions of Americans go to bed hungry every night and saying, oh, they were probably all on a diet. But what he found, what Reagan found, was the way, without being explicit, to play to these racial divisions and fears. So he didn't talk about race. He talked about welfare cheats. He talked about the welfare queen driving her Cadillac, who never existed, but that became a central story in his campaign. And in 1980, when he began the presidential campaign, he did not begin the campaign with a speech on tax cuts. He did not begin the campaign with a speech on communism. He began the campaign by going to Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the three civil rights workers had been murdered, and giving a speech on states' rights. And it was, you know, it was a shout out to as clear as could be. And it continued. You know, think about Willie Horton in the 1988 campaign. This strategy continued to work. People have asked me, do I think that Ronald Reagan was a racist? Do I think that George H.W. Bush was a racist? And the answer is no, not at all. I think what they were about is economics. What it's about is lowering tax rates at the top and privatizing Social Security. But race has been the way that elections have been won. Okay, so this is a happy book. Conscience of a Liberal is actually a happy book because I think that this is very nearly over. This whole process is in its last throes, I guess, as Dick Cheney would say. And there are a couple of reasons. One is that if you look broadly at how Americans think about issues, there's actually been a pronounced liberal trend in American public opinion over the past decade. You can see that in all kinds of issues. But it's an interesting thing. People say, you know, shouldn't you use the word liberal in the title of your book? Because people are not liberal. And it's true. If you ask people, are you liberal? Not very many people say they are. But if you ask people, do you think that the U.S. government should guarantee health insurance to everybody? Overwhelmingly, they say yes. If you say, would you be willing to pay somewhat higher taxes for that? And you only lose a few percentage points even there. So people actually are quite in favor of strong safety net, strong government taking care of people. The divisions that have been exploited so well, I think are losing their, more than I think, you can document that they are losing their effectiveness. Not gone, but losing their effectiveness. For one thing, on race, we're becoming a more diverse country. is quite simply the Latino and to some extent the Asian vote are just transforming the demographics of the electorate in a way that means that you can't play racial politics the way you used to. But there's a more fundamental, I think, more uplifting reason. We're just a better country. Racism is much diminished. I like to look at some of the hot button issue polls that are not really about politics in any direct sense, but give you a sense of how people think. So what do you think of interracial marriage? And in 1978, more than 50% of the public said, no, it's unacceptable. And only, I think, 36% said it was okay. Today, 77% think it's fine. So it's just we've changed in that respect. I thought the defining moment of the 2006 campaign, the real telltale moment, was the Macaca incident. George Allen... actually, California yuppie, but reinvented himself as a Southern good old boy, burst into an obscure racial slur against a young American man of South Asian descent. So there you get the increased diversity, who was, you know, trailing him with a video camera for the web campaign. That the racial insult, that's nothing new in American politics. What is new is that Americans won't stand for it. Virginians won't stand for it. We're not that country anymore. And so that's a transformation in the kind of country we are, which suggests that there's a huge opening now for a big change in direction. Where does that change in direction start? Well, healthcare. Healthcare is the great unfinished business of social insurance, of the welfare state in the United States. In no other advanced country do citizens worry that they may not be able to afford necessary medical care. In no other advanced country do they worry that they might be bankrupted, destroyed financially by expensive medical needs. Now you could say, well, we can't afford that, but then there's this amazing fact that the United States manages to spend far more on healthcare than in any other advanced country, and yet not cover people. And all of the things that you've heard about how terrible foreign healthcare systems are almost entirely fabrications, and particularly there are a couple of foreign systems, the slightly more generously funded ones, the French system, the German system, that are terrific. The quality is every bit as good as the best you can get here, and they cover everybody, and they do it at less cost. How is that possible? Our system is wildly inefficient. The system of, you know, our goal, almost everybody at least says that they think everyone should have health insurance, and yet we have a private insurance system that spends a great deal of money trying to find people, well, as I put it, you know, the snarky way, trying to find people who really need health insurance so as to deny them that insurance. It's business. You have to find you don't want to cover the high risk cases, which is why Medicare has overhead of about 3% of its budget, and private health insurance companies have overhead that's about 14% of their budget. The truth is, we're actually, little known fact, in the United States, the Medicare and Medicaid already pay more medical bills than private insurance companies do. The reason you might say, well, but most people have private insurance, yes, but think about who Medicare and Medicaid cover, the elderly, who are much more expensive. So the fact is, we're already, in terms of the dollars and cents, more than halfway to having a national healthcare system, but the trouble is, we leave large numbers of people uninsured, and it doesn't work. So if we can get healthcare reform, that in itself is a big plus for the American public, and it also has political implications. So one of the funny things I found is I'm actually in total agreement with William Kristol, the Weekly Standard. During the failure of the Clinton healthcare initiative in the early 90s, Kristol wrote a famous memo to Republicans saying, our goal is not to improve this plan, it is to kill it. And the reason was that if a universal healthcare plan of any form was passed, that it would reinvigorate liberalism, that it would reinvigorate the notion of a welfare state. And he was right. And if we can get it, then it will change the whole constellation, make lots of other things possible. I'm in an amazingly optimistic state of mind these days because I look at the political scene and I see these possibilities, Now, I'll give you a dose of pessimism in a minute, but you know, just so you know, I haven't completely lost my mind. You look at the political scene, and certainly the possibilities. There's a much more progressive mood in the electorate than we've seen. You know, for what it's worth, I've become big on political science measures, and the electorate appears to be more liberal than it has been since the early 1960s. And the Democratic on healthcare, which I think is issue number one, the Democratic candidates have all more or less converged on an approach that I think will work, which is not an immediate jump to Medicare for all, but is in fact a compromise, a transition that is pretty good, that would allow, with a moderate amount of additional revenue you can get not by a massive tax increase, but simply by allowing some of the Bush tax cuts to expire, would allow you to produce a system that would cover everybody and would put private insurance companies in competition with a public plan. And that would, in fact, go a long way. It's not the perfect system, but good enough. So I sometimes have to pinch myself, because remember, less than 3 years ago, we thought we were going to lose Social Security. It seemed like a desperate uphill fight to stop the privatization of the core of the New Deal. At this point, all of the leading Democratic candidates for president are actually pushing for are at least advocating a plausible, serious, well-designed plan for universal health insurance, which you could imagine actually happening in the first term of the next president. That's an amazing transition. Now, there are many big ifs. First of all, you know, elections, who knows what will happen in this election. Anyone who is absolutely certain, you know, we shouldn't be. Bigger issue, which I do worry about, beyond that, certainly another issue, if we do have a president, a Democratic president, will he or she actually follow through? During the Gilded Age, and we are living in a second Gilded Age, the only Democrats who got anywhere near the White House tended to be what were called at the time Bourbon Democrats, which was Democrats who were very nearly as much in the pocket of the robber barons as the Republicans of the time. Not quite, but very nearly. And so I sometimes say, I actually wrote this, I think, in the Times, that we hope we're about to elect another FDR. We might be about to elect another Grover Cleveland, which would be deeply disappointing if that's what happens. But it's an amazing turn. I think the last time I spoke to this group would have been probably 4 years ago. And it was, for someone of my views, I think for everyone, it was a really grim time. And it was terrible feeling that things had gone wrong. And of course, many things have gone wrong. But things are better. And the trends are going in what I see as the right direction. The things we feared, the terrible wrong turn we feared America might take, didn't happen. This has, in fact, turned out to be the country that I hoped it was. And I'm feeling so optimistic that I probably should see a doctor. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul Krugman, for your comments this evening. My name is Bob Saldick. I'm chairman of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and I am going to attempt to summarize your questions. There are 700 people here, and we have at least 700 questions, so I'm going to do my best.
You've got one economist, so I must have three different opinions on each question. So anyway, sorry.
There's a lot of questions about the middle class, and they range all over the map. So let me read a few of them to you, and you can kind of synthesize them. Please describe the standard middle-class family. I don't know whether I'm one or not. Why should I even care about the depleting middle class? Given globalization's downward pressure on the wages of the unskilled and the semi-skilled, how much scope do we realistically have to raise the compensation of the working and lower middle class? Middle class wage jobs requiring only a high school education are disappearing. How will those with a high school education or less be accommodated in this market, and so forth and so forth?
All right. Yeah. So let's talk. I mean, middle class is a an elastic term. And in the United States, famously, everybody thinks they're middle class. So people with incomes between around $20,000 and $400,000 say they're middle class. Actually, one of my favorite lines ever is from the movie Wall Street, where Michael Douglas says to Charlie Sheen, "Do you want to be another working Wall Street stiff making $400,000 a year?" And that was 1988 when $400,000 actually bought something. But look, there are certain essentials of middle class existence: health insurance, home ownership, or at least the ability to buy a home if you should so choose, not being on the edge, so that you're not in a position where if one spouse has a temporary layoff or there's a medical emergency, all your life whole falls apart. In 1970, the great majority of Americans were middle class in that sense. Much less true now. So there's a great sense of insecurity. This notion that you can't have a middle class in the face of a global economy, that's a uniquely U.S. perception. Again, health insurance is essentially a birthright in other advanced countries. It comes from the because they have a system that guarantees health insurance to everyone, and it's certainly affordable. The only reason we don't there's a long story actually. The reason we don't in the United States has a lot to do with the politics of race. Again, if the closest we ever came to getting a universal health insurance system so far was in 1947 when Harry Truman tried to get one, and he was blocked by a coalition between the American Medical Association and Southern politicians who were afraid that it would lead to integrated hospitals. Wages. Most of the economy is not competing with low-wage labor. The service sector, Walmart workers, are not competing with Chinese labor. They're selling Chinese products, but they're not competing with Chinese labor. And in any case, there are a lot of things you can do to supplement. We have a program called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which raises the wages of lower-income workers. It could be bigger. But you look and Canada, European countries, they have their problems, but they are all actually solidly middle class in the way we used to be and are no longer. And that's a choice, not something that the global economy is imposing on us.
A lot of people are wondering about the whole issue of inequality, and let me summarize their questions with these two. Does America's unparalleled rise in productivity relate to its unparalleled rise in inequality? And secondly, you've written recently about the new Gilded Age and the disparity of wealth in this country. Do you think gross inequality in wealth is an evil in itself and that it should be eliminated? What policies would you envision to eliminate this disparity?
Okay, so let me try and keep those two things. Let me try and hold the second one in mind. I may ask you about it. So let me talk about the productivity issue. By and large, I think people have bought into a myth about how wonderfully superior American performance is that is not actually true. I actually do talk about this in the book at some length. So let's talk about the enemy, France. And how does French productivity, output per hour, compare with the United States? And the answer is, it's actually just about the same. If you look at there are a couple of different measures, and this stuff is, economic statistics are just a peculiarly boring form of science fiction. So. The most of the sources actually suggest that French productivity is maybe a couple of percent higher per hour than the United States. But anyway, it's close enough so that it's within, we don't really, within margin of error. French GDP per person is about 25% less than the United States. So how does that happen? About half of it is that the French work shorter hours because they take longer vacations. And that's a choice. They've set it up. America is the no vacation nation. We work very, very long hours, take very few days off. The French have a combination of labor laws and other things that basically lead to people taking a month of vacation. And in the United States, most people take less than 2 weeks. That's a choice. You know, argue it back and forth. You know, the French think that they've actually made a better choice. But that's not a problem. That's a choice. They have lower employment as a share of the population. That's the other half. And that turns out to be three parts. Prime-age workers in France, 25 to 54. 80% of French adults between the age of 25 and 54 are working, which is exactly the same as the United States. So if you're looking at, if your vision is that there's huge numbers of unemployed French people with no employment in you know, middle-aged French people with no job prospects, it's just not true. They're exactly as likely to be working as we are. And that's, you know, young French are much less likely to be employed, under 25, than Americans. To some extent, that probably is because job opportunities are more limited. There are some problems there. But a large part of it is two things. The French are more likely to be in school because the financing is available. They're less likely to be unable to attend college. And if they are in college, they're much less likely to have to work their way through. So, again, because of more generous state support. So those actually sound like good things. Not clear that the low employment of young French is a problem. So the one thing that was really clearly they've screwed up is the pension policies. Mitterrand created a set of pension policies that make it way too easy to retire with nearly full income at the age of 55. And so the French have, and they can't afford it. But, you know, it's a very, so we say, well, inequality, American inequality is essential to our productivity. And then you compare it with France, which has much less and this much more generous social welfare state, and it turns out that the French problem is they screwed up their retirement policy. It's not something cosmic. It's not a basic fundamental flaw of trying to have a more equal society. And they have health care that is as good as or better than ours, and it covers everybody at 65% of the cost of the U.S. system. In many ways, they do better. But, of course, you know, everybody knows that we're at the cutting edge of technology, so just look at the future, except it ain't true. Turns out that broadband is now more widely available and faster in France than it is in the United States. We're actually losing that edge, too. So the whole notion that the U.S. has done so wonderfully and that justifies all of the brutality of our society is just based on ignorance. It's just not, you know, that. I think a lot of rhetoric in the United States, political rhetoric, depends on the notion that Americans have no idea what life is actually like in other countries.
Question for the liberals. Liberals were trashing the bourgeois middle class, the Archie Bunker union members, and the Constitution written by, quote, rich white male slaveholders for decades. When did they change their minds?
Who are these people? I mean, you can find them, right? One of these weird things about U.S. politics right now is that if there's some college professor someplace who says something crazy on the left, that is supposedly taints the whole, you know, the whole Democratic Party, the whole progressive movement. I don't know why. Whereas on the other hand, you can have somebody who's, you know, sort of, well, you know, Mitt Romney introduced Ann Coulter at a Republican meeting and talked about what a great person she is, and somehow what she says isn't taken to taint the whole. It's a weird double standard. So, the notion that this is that liberals were anti-bourgeois, anti-middle class. This is you find a few people, or sometimes just make them up. It never happened, and certainly nobody I know was part of that.
We have dozens of questions about the current political campaign, and I know the New York Times frowns on your picking anyone, but if we treat it as confidential...
No, I can't. That's right. The rules are I can't do endorsements, and I guess in principle you don't know which party I'd like to see win the election. I used to say my preferences were as obscure as those of William Safire, and David Brooks doesn't make quite as good of a foil. So, anyway... So was there a question in there that needed...
Moving right along.
Yeah.
Although this isn't quite the subject of your book, you can't escape the subject of the Bush administration and war. So we have multiple questions about exactly when will we invade Iran and whether it can be stopped. I think that summarizes them.
I know nothing that any citizen who tries to keep well informed doesn't know. Right, we have the data. We have the reports. We have investigative reporting by people like Seymour Hersh, who actually have contacts inside, which are very scary. It's not very hard to look at the realities and what we know about what the state of American forces, what bombing campaigns can and can't accomplish. To say, my God, this would be an incredibly stupid, disastrous thing if there is an attack on Iran. But we also know enough from the history of the last 6 years to know that simply because something is obviously a really, really bad idea doesn't mean it won't happen. I have nothing more to say. I've written about it a bit in the Times, and it's one of those things that really, really scares you. I mean, these are times when you go, even now, as I say, I'm very optimistic about some of the turn that the political, domestic politics has taken, but we still have in the White House the people who were responsible for this war, and the war we're already in, and they have shown very little sense of reality in dealing with these problems. So something bad could very definitely happen.
Ducking back to the question of inequality for a moment, a lot of questions about why the society has allowed our executives to make as much money as they make, and questions about Merrill Lynch. The chairman of Merrill Lynch has just been fired, and they announced today that he does not have a severance package, so his package is now reduced to about $150
million. 159, I believe,
159,
yes.
Excuse me.
This is an interesting story. What's interesting is actually what used to restrain executive pay, right? Chief executives have always been in the position of appointing the board that decides how much they should be paid. So what stops that from being runaway insider advantage? The answer was that in the past there were external forces. In fact, the academic literature on this stuff refers to the outrage constraint on executive pay. That there were unions that would raise a fuss if the executive was paid huge amounts, especially if wages were being cut at the same time. There were the political figures. Politicians would hold hearings. There would be an outcry in the media. What happened is all that went away. What happened is that all of those institutions that acted as an external check went away. And what's interesting is that's not just me as somebody who thinks it's a bad thing who says this. If you go back, there's Michael Jensen and Kevin Murphy are academics who became well known for advocating executive pay that was more closely linked to performance. They basically were the gurus of stock options back in the 80s. In Wall Street, in the movie, the Gordon Gekko "Greed is Good" speech is actually very nearly a transcription of some of the Jensen Murphy papers. So it's kind of you can take it right out of the Harvard Business Review at the time. They were saying that this will lead to much higher pay, but it will lead to better results. So the question was, well, why aren't corporations already doing this? And their answer was, there are all these external pressures. So the people who think that higher executive pay is a good thing also believe that what used to happen is that essentially the political environment limited executive pay. And this is one of those prime examples of how politics drives economics. Now, it's turned out that the wonders that higher executive pay were supposed to produce have not exactly materialized. In the famous, they used to say, we pay executives like bureaucrats, so they behave like bureaucrats. So now we don't pay them like bureaucrats, and they behave like riverboat gamblers. CEO pay is one of those key examples of how a change in the political situation has totally transformed the way the market seems to work. Again, the CEO pay explosion is unique to the United States.
On the Sunday talk show this week, you argue that Social Security is not in big trouble. If that's true, why do so many Democratic presidential candidates, or are they getting this wrong?
Barack Obama talked about it. I haven't. Here's the thing about Social Security. It's Social Security may have a financing problem, though we're not even sure of that. If the economy grows strongly, if productivity growth is good, then Social Security is actually funded in perpetuity. So we're not even sure there is a problem. And if there is a problem, it's one that is 35 years in the future. But Social Security has, for whatever reason, become the favorite. It's become the issue that if you're a Beltway insider, the way you show that you're serious is by saying, well, you need to do something about Social Security. Because it's kind of easy to explain. You know, the population is getting older, and we have these problems, and the charts say that the cost of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid is going to get much worse. Of course, there is no program called Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, one word. And if you actually go dig in, you discover that it's Medicare and Medicaid, and it's not the aging of the population. The aging of the population is a serious but not huge issue for the federal government's finances. It's rising medical costs that drive it. But in any way, the Social Security has become this thing where it's you've proved that you're serious, and you say, well, when Social Security was founded, there were only the three recipients for every 20 workers or something, and now that you go through the numbers, which are turn out to be totally misleading. And there's this great temptation. One of the big problems I think Democrats have had is that they're Democratic politicians want the approval of insider Washington opinion. They want the approval of the commentariat, as I put it, of which I'm a member, but slightly ashamed of. And that this happens. So they, but I was really shocked to see Social Security was for me, and a number of people, progressives was the turning point. Here was, for the first time during the Bush years, we actually won one, and we were able to say, look, this is a very good program with at worst minor financing issues, and they're trying to undermine it, and you roll it back. And yet, there is this tendency among some Democratic politicians to say, well, we need to do something about Social Security. On a list of problems for the United States, that's not even in the top 10. And we were all a little bit shocked that Barack Obama would make an issue of that this recently. And what sounded a little out of touch.
Back to the issue of race. This question goes as follows. As a mixed-race Democrat, I question the importance of race in people turning to the GOP. Instead, I think it was the frustration that even Democrats like myself feel with a Democratic Party that is incapable of focusing and prioritizing. True?
I don't think that's right. I think if you... Now, look, there was certainly the Democratic Congress... Democrats controlled the House of Representatives for 50 years. And a certain amount of, sense of entitlement, just lack of urgency settled in. They got complacent. But... The numbers are just so compelling. I'll give you another comparison. I gave you the one about votes. The Democrats controlled the House of Representatives with about a 30-seat majority in 1954. The Republicans controlled the House of Representatives with a majority of about 30 seats in 2004. How did that shift come about? Where were the Republican gains? The answer is more than all of them were in the South. The Republicans had actually lost ground in the North. There's nothing in there. Nothing happened except that the South switched sides. When we say the South switched sides, we're talking about Southern whites. You look at the 2006 election, and there's only one major demographic group that voted Republican, and it is Southern whites. So it really gets pretty hard to argue that that's not a key factor in what happened.
The Sunday Times had an article in their magazine section about evangelicals losing their political clout. If the evangelicals become less a central part of the Republican Party, how different then are centrist Democrats from centrist Republicans? Do you think centrist Republicans want, as you suggest, to repeal the New Deal?
Who are these centrist Republicans? No, I mean, that is really the question. If you look on economic issues, every Republican in the House of Representatives and every Republican in the Senate is to the right of every Democrat. John McCain is often described as a centrist, but if you look at his actual economic views, they're substantially to the right. He is very much on that side of things. Look at the Republican presidential field. Every single candidate is basically preaching supply-side economics. The way to increase revenue is to cut taxes. There used to be. I think basically Lincoln Chafee was the last centrist Republican, and he's no longer in the Senate.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with economist Paul Krugman. We're discussing what happened to the middle class and where to go from here. A question from the audience. Your book, The Great Unraveling, is mainly about economic disappointment, bad leadership, and the lies of the powerful. And that's a quote. If we stay the course, how much worse can things get in the last year of the Bush administration? Oh. And incidentally, what's going to happen to the economy now?
All right. Oh, you know, that's the joke, right? I was feeling depressed and out of sorts, and then a voice came to me and said, "Cheer up, things could be worse." So I cheered up, and things got worse. Things could get much, much worse, right? I shudder at the questions about Iran. That's terrifying. How does oil at $140 a barrel sound to you, right? You know, there are things that could be really bad. The economy. When I was much, much younger, we did read Marx, Das Kapital, and not that I was ever, by the way, a Marxist, but the third volume is about to explain to you why class theory, which doesn't actually seem to make sense, works. And just at the point where it's about to explain it, just the manuscript stops. Now I have this vision. So I'm about to explain to you about the economy. I'm just about to keel over. Anyway, sorry. Okay. Housing has, it turns out to be one of the great financial market failures of history. We've had this enormous housing bubble, which has created at least $4 trillion and possibly as much as $8 trillion of essentially fictitious wealth. A lot of people were lent money with mortgages that they didn't understand and were suckered in. And a lot of people bought investments that consisted of dubious home mortgages sliced and diced and repackaged into financial instruments they didn't understand. So we have a big problem there, which is causing a lot of distress in the economy. Is it a recession? Are we doomed to a recession? Not necessarily, because the criteria for recession are really pretty stiff. We're certainly doomed to a period of slow growth and a lot of financial distress. Believe it or not, one of the things people worry about, which is the weak dollar, is actually good news on that front, because the one thing that is helping to cushion the effects of the housing slump is an export boom, which is finally taking place. So there are some good things, but it's the good thing is the United States is, despite the management of recent years, is a huge, huge dynamic economy. It can take a lot of bad news. We are not Argentina. It's much harder to get a real crisis scenario for the U.S. But you know, we're working on it, I guess. The housing thing has been, I was writing about housing 2.5 years ago already with great concern, but it's actually turned out to be even worse than I thought it would be.
Well, that's depressing. Unfortunately, we've come to the time in our program when there's only one last question, and I'd like to ask a question from your new book. In your new book, you close by asserting that really today Democrats are the new conservatives. Could you summarize why you take that position?
Yeah. Think about the Social Security debate. Well, we had an attempt by the Bush administration, which was one that was longstanding, a goal, to basically rip up this program. Now, Social Security has been a part of American life for 72 years. It is part of how we live. It is part of what makes old age tolerable for large numbers of Americans. What could be more radical than trying to take that program apart. And Democrats, in defending the program, were actually conservative in the proper sense of the word, trying to maintain the kind of society we have. Even things that I will call progressive, like trying to establish a guarantee of health care for every American, that's always been an ideal. And we used to be fairly close to having that with a relatively small uninsured population. So really, it's just trying to maintain the ideal. It's a conservative thing in some ways, even though it's progressive. No, the radicals, well, go back to my, Grover Norquist as James Bond villain quote, wanting to bring America back to the way it was before the New Deal, before Teddy Roosevelt, is not conservative. That's deeply radical. That's trying to turn us into a society of a type we haven't been in the lifetime of anyone living. And so, sure, the Democrats are in effect the true conservatives in the sense that they want to keep our society the kind of middle class, broadly democratic society that we have been.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Paul Krugman, op-ed columnist for the New York Times, professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University, and author of The Great Unraveling and The Conscience of a Liberal. This program has been generously sponsored by ORIC, a global law firm, as part of our AHA series. We thank our audiences here and on the radio and on television. I'm Bob Saldick, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.